How understanding 2 Peter teaches us to read the rest of the Bible. This is part 16. The title I gave it, not surprisingly, The Day of the Lord Will Come Like a Thief. The Day of the Lord Will Come Like a Thief. The text is 2 Peter 3, 10 to 13. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar. The heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, as he just wrote, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness? Waiting for and hastening the coming of the Lord God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting, there's the verb, waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. When you study this whole letter in sequence, the balance of Peter's teaching kind of shines a bit more brightly. In verses 8 and 9, he writes to fortify the patience of saints with regard to the delay in the coming of Jesus. But do not overlook this one truth, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all, those are big words, but that all should reach repentance. But for every 10 believers who are impatient about the second coming of Christ, there are probably 100 who don't think about it enough. That's where the verses from our text come into play. When you look at 3, 11, and 12, since all these things are to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness? Look at that. Thank you, sir. What sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness? So there are implications of this. Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved. Heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. So when it comes to our response to the truth of the second coming of Jesus, both impatience, where is the promise of his coming? And indifference, we have all sorts of time, eat, drink, be merry. Impatience and indifference, both of those are going to lead to serious problems. And that's why Peter addresses them each in turn in his letter. In today's text, he's going to confront indifference to the coming of the day of God. First, Peter deals with the unexpected fact of the second coming. That's in 10. And then he offers 3 responses to that. That's in 11, 12, and 13. So that's what we're going to be doing in the next few minutes. Point number 1, the day of the Lord, Peter says, will come suddenly, unexpectedly, and will be a cataclysmic event. You see that in 3:10. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. And then the heavens will pass away with a roar. The heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Peter didn't just make this idea up about the day of the Lord coming like a thief. He didn't just make that up. He got that idea from Jesus. Jesus talked to him in the very same terms. He tells a parable, and then he says, therefore, stay awake. You do not know on what day your Lord is coming, but know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake. He would not let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready. The Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect. Okay, so remember, Peter is writing these words to encourage readiness for the day of the Lord. It's not enough for me just to have a doctrinal truth, not enough just to hope I'm ready. We have to be ready. And the main point in Peter's words is this. You can't prepare for the day of the Lord at the last minute. It's not going to be something you can clearly see coming. You can know approximately. There are signs, but no one knows the day nor the hour. You will always think you have more time. You will always maybe put off what needs to be done now unless you remember that this is the only time we have to prepare for the coming of Jesus. Right now is what we have. We've heard the phrase so often that it probably doesn't sound strange or shocking anymore. But it is, really. Why would the coming of our blessed Lord be likened to the break-in of a thief? Like, that's just weird. Jesus is holy. Thieves aren't holy. But that term, it's so carefully chosen to make the point that something is going to be taken from all of us when Jesus comes. That's what a thief does. Takes things. So something is going to be taken from every one of us when Jesus comes back. The thief is going to take something that I had up to that point, but I won't have after the thief comes. Okay? We all get it. We know how that works. So Peter now, think about this. Peter says there's a way in which that's what the coming of Jesus is going to do. The coming of Jesus is going to be, at least in one respect, like a thief. In that, when Jesus comes back, something will be taken from all of us that we had up to that point. Something very precious is going to be taken that we had taken for granted would be perpetually belonging to us, but it's going to be taken. Here's what it is. Jesus comes like a thief in that he takes away my last opportunity to get ready for his coming. It's gone. He removes it. So the thief comes. I know 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul says that day won't overtake you like a thief. But he's talking to that point about Christians who are ready, prepared, thinking about it. Jesus and Peter are dealing with people who don't think about it enough. That's the contrast. It's not a contradiction. So Jesus comes like a thief in that he takes our last opportunity to ready ourselves for his coming. He takes something more valuable than gold or diamonds or your investments or your stocks or your bonds. And the event will happen apparently so suddenly that there won't be time for these last minute refinements. I won't get that chance. When you're sound asleep, the thief comes in, takes all the silverware. It's too late to get up the next morning and set the alarm. You have to do that the night before. So Peter's message to churches like ours and people like we is simply this. You can't just plan at some point to get ready. You have to be ready. Preparedness is a lifestyle. It's a perpetual, moment by moment, constantly getting ready more and more. It's not a last minute getting ready. Be ready instantly. Be ready always. Be ready consistently. Never be not ready for the coming of Jesus. Never be not ready. It's a readiness that's hard to put into simple words. I guess we don't want to be judgmental, but in our quiet hearts, we can all think of people who aren't ready. Why aren't they? Well, usually it's because they don't make day-by-day decisions based on the needs. They make day-by-day decisions based on the needs they discern at that moment. They don't feel like going to church, so they don't go. They haven't got time to do devotion, so they don't do them. Something else creeps in. Something else is important. But people who are constantly preparing for the coming of Jesus don't live like that at all. They make present decisions based on future events. That's how they do it. They make every decision based on the impact it will have on their joy or their shame at that future moment when Jesus comes back. And now, little children, there's the constant ongoing activity. That's the verb. Abide in him, that's Jesus. So that when he appears, that's his second coming, we may have confidence and not shrink from him. Look at these words. Shrink from him in shame at his coming. And then Peter says something else about the event of the second coming itself. He says, not only will the event be sudden and unexpected, he says, in ways that we can't really get our heads around, I guess, he says it's going to destroy everything that we've come to treasure as we know it now. That's in 3:10. I mean, you have to do something with these words. The day of the Lord will come like a thief. We looked at that. But the heavens will pass away with a roar. Heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved. The earth and the works that are done in it will be exposed. In fact, Peter actually says, did you notice? We will not just see Jesus come. We'll hear with our own ears the sound of everything around us being burned up. Have you seen every once in a while someone catches a video of a tornado and it's on the news and you just hear the sound of it, eh? People even talk about it. It was like a train coming. The whole house just shook just with the noise of the tornado. Heavens will pass away with a roar. Peter says it will be loud. Standing close to a huge bonfire, that kind of sound. So not only will there be the sound of the trumpet, there will be the roar of this present world somehow being consumed. Why is Peter talking like this? He's not saying these things just for dramatic effect. He's not just trying to scare the people in these churches. His concern is more practical. It's more down to earth. These false teachers, we looked at that in chapter 2, remember? These false teachers, they're working overtime to to just entice these churches into continuing in their own earthbound, desire-driven lifestyles. Nothing urgent. And Peter addresses their message head-on, the false teachers. Any kind of prosperity teaching that ties your attention more to material things in this world than setting your soul on the things that are going to be burned up with a roar when Jesus returns, don't listen to it. There are all sorts of teachers on TV and in the media that are trying to teach you to love material goods more and more and not less and less. Peter says, don't listen to them. It's all going to be burned up. Life will be stripped away to its essentials, confidence or shame. We won't have anything else to hide behind or cling to for security or peace of mind. The actuality of the Lordship of Jesus in my life will be exposed because everything else will be stripped away. Works that are done on it will be, see that? Exposed. No excuses, Don. So that is the event that Peter calls the day of the Lord or the day of God. He says it's going to be sudden, cataclysmic, unexpected. It will destroy everything that we've clung to in its wake. And Peter says we must never forget that day of the Lord is actually going to come. You have to put the hit on the right words in 3:10. You can read the day of the Lord will come, or you can, the day of the Lord will come. It's going to come. People might not be thinking about it, but it's going to come. It's going to happen. It'll come. The day of the Lord is going to come. Point number two. Knowing the coming of the day of the Lord, there are three things every careful Christian should do. I'm looking at 11 to 14. Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved. Heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. We looked at that. But according to his promise, we are, there it is again, waiting for the new heavens and the new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, since you are, again, waiting for these things, be diligent to be found in him without spot, without blemish. And isn't that something? At peace. You talk about people that are going to be ashamed, just be at peace. First, we must be waiting for the day of the Lord. So there's anticipation. Then we must be preparing for the day of the Lord. And then Peter says we must be hastening the day of the Lord. Those three things. We're going to look at one today and we'll do two next Sunday if Jesus hasn't come back. So A, waiting. We must be waiting for the day of the Lord. 2 Peter 12 and 13. Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for the heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. If I read the three verses, three times in three verses, Peter says we're to be waiting for the day of the Lord. Our sights are to be constantly set on this event. Hasn't happened yet. But I'm to be anticipating its coming. It's the exact opposite. Waiting and anticipating is the exact opposite of being sleepy about it, or just distracted. It's not denying it, distracted. Thinking about other things. You know, you get to be my age, and I have certain memories of long ago that become more precious to you. When we first moved here, we lived on 66 Kingston Row, and the living room had a bit of a bay window and a ledge that would be about that high that just went around like that in a semicircle. And every day I'd come home from work, and before I got there, Laurel would click her way over and lean on that ledge. And every day when I came home, she'd be looking out the window. How old would she have been, Rainey? She's doing this. See, I was going to say four. She was one. And she'd hold herself up, and she'd wait to see my car coming in the driveway. I know that's simple. It's a beautiful picture of I'm just waiting for someone. Only it's Jesus. But I'm at the window. My nose is bent against the glass. That's how I live life. I'm thinking about his coming. I'm longing for his coming. I can't wait for it. I'm not looking at anything else. I'm focused on this. It has my attention. I'm longing for the coming of the Lord. That's what's implied in that waiting. Let me try and show you another place where that same word, the same idea of waiting for something with expectation. Let me show you how it's used in the scriptures in another place. You'll get the idea. Peter and John, the lame man on the way to the temple. Seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, he asked to receive alms. Peter directed his gaze at him, as did John, and said, "Look at us." And he fixed his attention on them, expecting to receive something from them. "Please." And he sees they're gonna help him. And his face lights up. Oh. Expecting to receive something from them. That's the idea. That's the idea Peter has in mind when he says, "I'm to be looking for the day of the Lord." It's the issue is concentrated attention. I don't let myself forget. It's a humbling thing. We all should do it. Just stand in front of the mirror and say, what is it that you pin your hopes on in this world? What do you spend most of your time imagining? What could happen in the future that would satisfy and thrill you more than anything else right now? What do you look at as the solution to this world's problems? I mean, there are all sorts of wonderful accomplishments in science and education, environmentalism, medicine. It's lengthened all lifespans. We're becoming far and away the most prosperous people in the world. And Peter says, for all that, there's something you can't change. For all that, this world is on its way out. You and I are not made to last forever in this world. The world isn't made to stay in its present condition eternally either. And at the very center of the Christian's convictions is the position that this world, no matter what mankind may do, it's going to wrap up. History's coming to a close, and it's going to end with the day of the Lord. Three times in three verses, I'm told to be waiting for God's final plan for this world in which I live. Peter says Christians must wait for that day like children wait for Christmas, like an expectant mother waits for a new baby. And what Peter means is Christians are consumed. They're fixated on this. You can't get their attention off of it. Everything else fills their day. And it's pointless without the second coming. That's the point. It's pointless without the second coming. Of course, Christians do a lot of things. We drive cars. We wash clothes. We work in offices. We invest money. We do a lot of things, but Christians don't place their hope in any of those things. They don't place their hope in any of those things. This is what gives us one of our greatest chances for a visible witness in this uniformly distracted world. What should people see when they look at me as a Christian? That I don't smoke, or I don't drink, or I'm not into internet porn. I'm faithful to my wife. Well, there are atheists who live like that. What is it they should notice? Like, what should be striking? Well, they should see my longing for the return of Jesus. They should see my love for Jesus, my longing for Jesus, like a wife awaiting the return of her soldier husband from Iran. A restless love for the one I hold dearest. Without this witness about waiting for Jesus and his second coming, everything else I say about my Christian walk will have a cold and theological feel, an empty ring. The blessed hope needs to bring a visible sparkle, a pace to my life that they see he's counting on something totally different than I'm waiting for. My plea would be, give your heart regularly, give your heart an honest test. This is a heart test, okay? The most important kind of heart test. Give your heart an honest test with this. How many times on any given day of the week, not counting Sunday or when you're in church, how many times during the week do you just find yourself instinctively longing, almost out loud, "Oh, please come soon, Lord Jesus." It is the deepest longing of my life. It is the yearning of my heart. I long for you to come, and I long to see your face. Come and rule and reign. And here's you pray every day, "Lord, keep me from doing or desiring anything today that will make me feel shame." Is there a better prayer on earth than that? Keep me from doing or planning or thinking about things today that are going to make me feel shame. Isn't it beautiful the way John said, to see him and we're going to be at peace? That's my prayer for you. That when Jesus comes back, there won't be shame. There will be contentment and peace. Bow with me, would you?